listeners are. I'm Steve Winton, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. The topic today is Afghanistan. We should be talking more about Afghanistan. It's so important. Things are heating up there. And it gets a little play in the major media, but of course they never tell you what really is going on or why or whatever. But I'm so delighted to have Peter Dale Scott on today to talk about it. Peter is a poet, he's an author, a researcher, and he's a former Canadian diplomat and UC Berkeley English professor. He's also an anti-war activist going back many, many years to the 1960s. And he coined the phrase deep politics. And by that he means that in every culture and society, his words, in every culture and society, there are facts which tend to be suppressed because of the social and psychological costs of not doing so. In other words, my words, covert criminal acts, unaccountable, lawless, self-serving, that hide disturbing truths about major events like the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, all sorts of other things, including what may be going on regarding the present global economic crisis. Peter has a fairly new article published earlier in May on globalresearch.ca, and he calls it Afghanistan, Heroin-Ravaged State. And he explains the gap between national security establishment policies and outside expert opinions calling for a post-imperial society in a multipolar world. We want to talk about the article, what's going on in Afghanistan, and always Peter's thinking about this and other important things on his mind. Peter, I'm so delighted to have you back in the program. It's been much, much too long.
Oh, Stephen, I'm glad to be back, too. And thank you for that excellent summary of my position at the beginning. Could I say a bit more about deep politics in America?
Oh, absolutely.
Because, as you said correctly, that you find deep politics probably in any organized society. But when you have a democracy that is playing the role of an empire, then deep politics becomes much, much more important because if we were conducting foreign policy by democratic vote, most Americans wouldn't want to be fighting in Afghanistan or, saber rattling in all corners of the world. The U.S. military right now are committed to a policy of global security domination with the ability to control any situation anywhere. This is a kind of madness which I think can only exist in circles at the very top that have excluded people who don't think that way. So you get a kind of mindset at the top proceeding in its own way and doing things which they want to conceal from the American people. And that's why we have a CIA. It doesn't. So, you know, if you overthrow a government in, say, Latin America, the people there know all about it. It's the Americans who are kept in the dark. So that's why I consider deep politics to be so important in this country, which is still largely, I think, democratic in its in the hearts of ordinary people, but not up at the top.
Oh, indeed, Peter, that music means we need to take a short break. So let's do that and come back and continue the discussion. We'll be right back. Cascadia Public Radio. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Peter Dale Scott. We're talking about Afghanistan and whatever else Peter would like to raise during the hour. Peter, can I read one line? Oh, over 2 years ago, I wrote my own article on Afghanistan, a rather long one. I called it The Other Lost War, and I quoted John Pilger, who had a chapter in his newest book at the time
call Freedom Next Time. And just a brief line that he mentioned. He said, through all the humanitarian crises in living memory, no country has been abused and suffered more, and none has been helped less than Afghanistan. And then he went on to describe the country as he saw it when he visited it a few years ago. And he called it, one more thing, he called the capital Kabul at that time. He described what he saw as contours of rubble rather than streets, where people live in collapsed buildings like earthquake victims waiting for rescue with no light or heat, and he went on and so on. Well, I don't know what's going on now, but the people still continue to suffer grievously because what we did to that country, and it's why you call it a ravaged state, not a failed state.
Yes.
A heroin ravaged state.
Well, it's been ravaged by many things, but one of America's chief gifts to Afghanistan was the reinforcement of a heroin economy, which accounts for half of the national economy, and which is something which we consciously started and abetted back in the 1980s. This goes back actually to the mind of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was so interested in getting Russia out of Poland, his native country, that he, by his own admission, he induced Russia to invade Afghanistan by covert operations for two or three years before that, that created a situation where the Russians went in. No, there is no major power that is played with Afghanistan that cannot be accused of really shameful activities, starting with the British back in the 19th century, who didn't so much want to occupy it, they wanted to make sure it was friendly to India to keep the Russians out. And then, of course, the Russian invasion was unconscionable, even if Zbigniew Brzezinski had a role in inducing it. And the American response, I think, there's all kinds of things on the American side, but the role of the CIA in backing the most extreme of jihadi terrorists back in the 1980s, knowing that they were anti-American, but considering that, in Brzezinski's words, this wasn't important. So these three powers, all of them share a legacy of shame with respect to Afghanistan.
Oh, there's no question, and the people have suffered so grievously, but they don't take kindly to invaders, Peter, as you know, and they drove the British out back in the 18th and 19th century, and they drove the Russians out, and they're in the process of giving us a very, very rough time. I simply can't believe that we'll fare any better than the Brits or the Russians.
As I say in my article, one of the effects of foreign influence has been to separate the cities from the countryside. And that's a problem that will take a long, long time to heal. So that initially when America came in to drive out the Taliban, even the Taliban incorporated foreign elements. You know, they included the so-called Arab Afghans of Al-Qaeda, and Pashtuns from the Pakistan side of the border. So particularly in Kabul, they were initially happy to see the Americans come in. The problem is the way America has fought the war since 2001 has driven America's popularity down, 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 until I think there was a poll that said only 18% of Afghans wanted to see more American troops in the area. So whatever could have been done in 2001, forget it now. We are an unpopular presence in the country and will remain so as long as we conduct the policies we're conducting now.
And the same thing is true in Iraq. People could hope that we could come in and improve their lives. And, of course, in fact, we have decimated their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it seems to be what we do no matter where we go.
Maybe I'm too pessimistic. I'm a Canadian by instinct and as well as nationality. And so I tend not to think big. The problem in both these countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, that they are deeply divided, and partly, again, because of foreign influence, the boundaries of Iraq were not drawn by Iraqis. They were drawn in Versailles by the British and the French, who were trying to allot oil resources between the various countries. And Afghanistan's borders were never drawn at a conference. There was an Afghan kingdom. But its border with Pakistan is totally artificial. It goes along the top of the mountain range, but the tribes that live there are on both sides of the border, and the Pashtuns. There's been talk for decades of a Pashtunistan, which would unite the tribal areas or most of them in Pakistan with the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan, because they are naturally a cohesive social unit. And what's happening now is that the last power to obliterate the Durand line, as they call it, is America, because we are not respecting that line now and sending drones into Pakistan. Well, so this has now got to be a talk about Pakistan as well. We have dragged Pakistan into this conflict, and it's going to be even more dangerous when we are destabilizing a power that happens to be a nuclear power.
Oh, indeed so. And my co-host, editor Michel Chosudovsky, it's been a while since he's written about this, but he believes that part of our aim is to divide Pakistan and divide a couple of the other countries in the region. Well, Iraq, maybe Syria, Pakistan. I don't know about dividing Afghanistan, but maybe dividing Afghanistan too, the old divide and conquer idea. And
my problem with that, Stephen, is I don't think there's a very coherent we in Washington. I think there are different factions who want different things. And what I think the primary objective there is something we haven't mentioned yet, which is the oil and gas of Central Asia.
Oh, indeed.
So it was very clear at the end of the 1990s that Clinton at one point, and certainly parts of his cabinet, welcomed the Taliban as a way of stabilizing Afghanistan so that you could put both a gas pipeline and an oil pipeline through it coming out of Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. And so the phrase, or the word pipelinistan was coined. Two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, whose own petroleum resources are very limited, but whose strategic position is extremely important because of the huge new sources of oil and gas, both up in particularly Kazakhstan, but also Turkmenistan.
And Brzezinski himself, in his, I believe, 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard,
right?
Oh, he talked about Eurasia being this great, the greatest of all treasures, the grandest of all grand prizes, not his words, but and he defined Eurasia as extending from Germany and Poland all the way through Russia and China, including the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent. Well, my goodness, what a treasure that would be to control it. But this is his idea.
Right.
Anything?
Well, it's classic geopolitics. The origins of this idea go back 100 years, but that was before people realized how much oil and gas there was in Central Asia. At one point in the 1990s, when Clinton was getting involved, and by the way, we have to mention that Chevron and Exxon went into Kazakhstan and invested tens of millions. Then they had to get stuff out, and as of that moment, the only way they could get it out was through Russia, which meant that Russia could then tax, in effect, the profits by the rates they charge for their pipelines. So that's why there's been such aggressive pipeline politics. Brzezinski played a role in this, too. In 1995, he went to Azerbaijan, which is where the Baku oil fields are, and persuaded the government. Well, I won't get into the hanky-panky. I talk about it in my book, The Road to 9/11. We used al-Qaeda people to install a friendly ruler in Azerbaijan. And Zbig, I call him Zbig because he and I went to McGill together. I knew him as an undergraduate. Brzezinski persuaded Azerbaijan to sign on to a pipeline. They call it, what is it, the BTC pipeline that goes from the Baku oil fields in the Caspian Sea through Georgia, which is why all that Georgia stuff was so strategically important and ominous last year, through Georgia into Turkey, into the Ceyhan. So we're trying. America's strategy is to find non-Russian ways to get the oil out. And we will, lie, cheat, steal in order to build artificial pipelines, which don't make sense economically, but avoid Iran and try to keep America in a controlling situation.
And trying to circle the world with bases, Peter, we could talk about that a little bit, especially.
Yeah, they go together, of course. Yeah, you're right to mention that.
We need to break again. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Peter Dale Scott. Oh, we're talking about Afghanistan, U.S. imperialism. Peter, in a few weeks, I'll have Bill Engdahl come on the program. He's been on a few times, and he has a new book coming out that he'll send to me called Full Spectrum Dominance, the idea of a dominance over everything.
Right.
you know what it is, and we'll sure talk about it more on this program.
I quote from it in my article, and I frankly think it sounds slightly insane. They want to control any situation militarily. Surely, that language was evolved in the late 90s. Well, since then, we've seen Iraq and we've seen Afghanistan. How can anyone in Washington continue to talk about controlling any situation? We've seen a very vivid illustration of the severe limits and even counterproductivity of the application of military power.
Oh, it seems loony to me too, Peter, the idea that you can control everything. My goodness, we've been at war most recently in two countries since 2001, then in 2003, and I don't see us any closer to resolving anything. Nor do I think it's going to happen in the months or years ahead. And we keep spending all of this money.
And in the process, Stephen, we're losing. Up until 2000, no one ever thought that other powers could challenge the American presence in Latin America. The Monroe Doctrine was, it seemed almost like constitutional law. But Bush exhausted America's military capacity fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the Chavez in Venezuela was able to invite in the Soviet Navy for war games in the Caribbean, and America couldn't do anything about it. So we are very rapidly exposing ourselves. We're really by these two wars, we're demonstrating that we are in the final stages of American dominance of the world. And part of me, I think it would be good for America as a nation somehow to rid the world of this illusion that America can control the rest of it. I just hope that we climb off that self-appointed position of dominance in a peaceful way, and it doesn't end in war, because we do face the risk of even bigger wars than the war that we're facing right now. They're unresolved questions with Iran particularly, but also, as we see in the paper today, North Korea. Obama says he's going to take action to deal with North Korea. I hope the action is to get together with Russia and China to see what can be done collectively. But America's got to get back into the habit of solving, which it's never been terribly good at, of being a partner in global policies rather than just the big chief.
We seem to be expert at one thing, Peter. It seems as though in recent years, or maybe a good number of years, more than anything else, making enemies around the world. The more of this aggressiveness that we pursue, the more enemies we seem to make. And we open opportunities for countries like China to go into Latin America. And I believe China and Brazil now have a much stronger trade relationship than Brazil has with the U.S.
Yes, I think that what we... I'm going to say again what you just said, that one consequence of the unilateral application of American power all over the place is to unite all the other countries in organizations to resist that unilateral application of American power. That's sort of elementary diplomatics 1A. I mean, that's what you would expect to happen. We haven't mentioned, and I didn't mention it in my article, and I should have, the existence of what's now called the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. Initially, it was Russia and China and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, but Kyrgyzstan was the original five. Now observer status is being given to India, Pakistan, Iran. America said, okay, yes, we would like to join too, but this was back in 2005, and America was turned down. Now, it was turned down, I think, on the sort of official ground that America just isn't in that area. You know, we used to have something called the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and it was really essentially the United States and a few clients, but America is not an Asian power. And more importantly, I think what drove Russia and China together, who, you know, were shooting at each other not too long ago, is they have united to find a way in which America isn't unilaterally imposing itself in that area. And I think America should try again to get in with the promise that it's going, I mean, the price of that would be to renounce its unilateral policies, like fighting the war in Afghanistan and so on. You saw, again, just on Sunday, when you had Karzai and Ahmadinejad, I can never pronounce that name, of Iran, and Zardari of Pakistan, the three of them got together to reduce terrorism and drug trafficking in the area. And America was not invited, and the American press, I think, felt this was kind of ominous, you know, that these countries are learning they can do things without America, and they will learn this more and more, for sure.
Well, I think we're going to see more and more of this, Peter, and the idea that we have a national security strategy that says we can preemptively use nuclear weapons, including against non-nuclear states. I mean, this is insane stuff.
Yeah.
It has to anger and scare people. We need to take another break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Peter Dale Scott. Peter, you mentioned the SCO. I have to believe that came about in self-defense against encroaching U.S. imperialism. And, of course, the core two countries, China and Russia, and then a number of the stand countries. And, I wish India would more solidly turn to that part of the world instead of seeming to ally mostly with the U.S. and Western interests and I guess the seduction of the offerings that we can make, the nuclear deal that we struck, and so on, and we seem to send a lot of our service economy over to India, a lot of our manufacturing economy over to China, but China and Russia very definitely see us as targeting them. Russia as the only other military superpower that can challenge us. And China, no military lightweight, but an economic superpower growing, not on a par with us yet, but growing so fast, including this very dire economic time where their economy still is growing, whatever true percentage it really is. Most others are sinking, and they're growing.
Good answer to the people who believe that the free market is the laissez-faire is the way to have the most progress, because in this time of crunch, the only powers that are surviving are the ones which have pursued a more kind of national economic strategy and have not trusted the market to solve all their problems, but have put elements of common sense into it. Now, of course, China has its own problems. As you know, I'm a former diplomat, and my bias is I welcome the fact that a country like India, and India and Pakistan, by the way, the two of them both have observer status with the, we're going to call it the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. It's a very important fact in the area, that SCO, which doesn't get much coverage. It's good that they're together, and I think it's good that India and China are developing trade relations with America, because if China's trade relationship with America is ever shattered, then the chances of a really horrible world war become much greater. Trade is the best insurance we have against that happening. So I think America should have welcomed the SCO. I think some American individuals did. And we need to see all kinds of multilateral approaches, regional and continental and intercontinental. The trouble with globalization as we have it now, it's not the fact that the world is becoming more unified. It is that it is becoming unified in a very top-heavy way, that it's big multinationals that are driving the policies. And we need to get some more kind of, the idea of the UN, which is a bit outdated now dealing with these new realities, and particularly to deal, even OPEC isn't covering the oil industry the way it used to. As I say, that's where I'm coming from, because I'm a former diplomat, and also because I'm a Canadian, and Canada has always depended on, had a tremendous stake in seeing peace between America and Russia, because otherwise all the bombs would have been flying over our heads.
Oh, how true. Well, I absolutely agree, Peter, that diplomacy is the only way to go. Unfortunately, the way we do it out of Washington, we want it to be in a way that we're dominant and other nations submit to our will. So
in Washington, the Defense Department has something like 9 times the budget of the State Department. And this has been a development that's been getting worse and worse through the years, that the State Department was very powerful. But even up till World War II, it called the shots. But we created this Department of Defense after World War II, and like a cancer, it is expanded, and that plus the CIA have eroded the power of the State Department. And we still, we have good diplomats, but as we saw in the Bush administration, the State Department, and particularly Colin Powell, just didn't have the clout that Rumsfeld and the Defense Department had. And that is an extremely important fact about America that we have to realize, which is the shrinking away of the State Department's traditional role.
And the power of the military. I've written a line or two and a couple of articles many months back on Pakistan, Peter, talking about Pakistan being a military that has a country. And very sadly, it seems like the U.S. is very similar, that the military is so, so powerful in this country with all of the commercial elements tied into it, not just the defense contractors, but all of the corporate interests that profit from our militarism around the world, and including ones like Kellogg Brown and Root Halliburton, that builds all these military bases around the world. It's astonishing. There are estimates that we have maybe 1,000 or more bases, including shared ones and secret ones. And I mean, they're all over the place. We couldn't imagine if another country had a base in a suburb of a city that we lived in, and they have thousands of troops there, and they have their planes rocketing over our heads, making all kinds of racket. I mean, we couldn't imagine living under conditions like that.
This is what Eisenhower warned America about.
Oh, yeah.
The industrial conflict. But the I think when Eisenhower made the warning, he saw it as a threat to the civilian economy. And what's happened since then is that the military has grown and grown domestically, as you also, you know, and so that the civilian economy now is overshadowed by the, and people talk now about the petroleum military industrial complex or the financial military industrial complex. What used to be a kind of balance between the civilian economy and the military economy has become definitely militarized. There was an opportunity for Obama to do something about this, but I think this is much bigger. It's beyond Obama's power. I think he's doing a lot of things which, because he's a very smart guy, Obama, he's doing things which maybe he himself can see are dangerous, but the price for survival in Washington is to buy into this, what I call the dominance mindset. If you want to be a player in Washington or even in the big media, you have to subscribe to this idea that America's role is to dominate the world, and if you challenge that, you marginalize yourself. So we're in, this is the subtext of my Afghanistan article, that there's no shortage of rational people in this country. It's just that to exercise common sense on these problems is to sort of rule yourself out of being part of this global dominance mindset.
Oh, very definitely, Peter. There are so many strands that we could talk about, and we could probably use every hour in Republic's day-to-day and still not be able to cover it all. But in your article, you talk about the role of heroin, and heroin is half of the Afghan economy. It's half of the of Pakistan's economy. The CIA is heavily involved in drugs trafficking. The banks, the major banks here in this country, heavily involved in laundering the money to big profits center for them. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, well, that is actually probably the main theme of the article, and we've taken a while to get to it. But, you know, everyone, this is why I say it's important to think of Afghanistan as a ravaged state rather than a failed state. This is not a situation that Afghanistan has created. Foreign powers have implanted the global heroin traffic in Afghanistan before 1979, when Brzezinski, I keep coming back to, started playing power politics in Afghanistan. Afghanistan had never been part of the global heroin situation. They grew opium. They grew far more marijuana for hashish. Hashish is the drug of choice in that country. But because we in Pakistan backed elements in Afghanistan against the people that the Russians were backing, the people we preferred had very little popular base in Afghanistan, but they compensated for that partly with American aid, and a lot of that went into building up a major heroin industry, developing heroin labs either inside Pakistan or inside Afghanistan, always where the Pakistan ISI, their intelligence agency that works with CIA. And suddenly, Afghanistan, which had never supplied any heroin of significance to America as late as 1978 or 79, by 1980, according to, I better say 81 because I'm not sure, but within a year or two, by American DEA estimates, 60% of the heroin in this country was coming from the Afghan-Pakistani border, and Pakistan had almost no heroin addicts, had hundreds of thousands by the mid-1980s. So it's a terrible social tragedy, which was politically generated. We, and most Americans don't know that when America went back into Afghanistan in 2001, one of the first things they did was to arrange for major drug traffickers either to be released from jail or in one case to be approached in Dijon, France, where this man had retired and told to come back to Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban. Because the Taliban, if you'll remember, had actually outlawed growing opium for 1 year. I won't go into their motives. It wasn't necessarily for the best of motives, but it is a fact that they virtually they reduced Afghan opium production to 185 tons, and all of that was being grown up in the northeast where our ally was. And now, of course, 93% of the world's opium heroin comes from Afghanistan, 93%. And it is thoroughly corrupted everybody. It's corrupted the Karzai government. Karzai's brother is supposed to be involved. Karzai is now criticized by America for tolerating this. But, I mean, it's the fact of life in Afghanistan, just as the military is a fact of life here. And that's what Karzai has to deal with. There are major, major traffickers who are in the government, who are in the Senate. And we call it the Afghan heroin situation, but there's maybe somewhere between $4 and $7 billion of all that money stays in Afghanistan. And according to the UN, the figure is probably too high, but it generates $100 billion overall. So most of the money is being made in Western Europe. And again, according to the UN, some of that money is keeping banks afloat in this present economic crisis because it's very difficult to put an exact figure on the global drug traffic, but it is a factor in the global economy and a significant one. And particularly in times of crisis like this, when everyone's desperate to get new sources of capital, the drug traffic is a very obvious source, and that's why I predict that you're not going to see this drug traffic stamped out when capital is necessary to save the Western capitalist economy.
Oh, and I think it's so profitable all the time, Peter, that it's
corrupting. It corrupts everyone it touches.
And when government either winks and nods or gets involved or top people in government get involved, it is easy money, and you can offshore it to a tax haven. You can get very rich. Nobody knows about it except you and your associates. And I mean, why give it up? We did the same thing in Southeast Asia, the Golden Triangle, when we were there, and Colombia, and you mentioned this, and it's just ugly, ugly stuff. I ran across some numbers, I forget the precise numbers, a couple of years ago, that said the illicit drug trade, all types involved, exceed the legal drug trade. And the legal drug trade worldwide is a huge, huge market. But the illicit trade is bigger than the legal trade.
Well, probably, yes. All of these estimates are of course, guesstimates. But the factor to emphasize is that it's important economically, and it's also important politically, because you said a while back the CIA is drug trafficking. The way I would put that is that when the CIA goes into a country where drugs are a factor, they count on, they look for assets in the drug sector, because those people are not going to be communists. They believe in profits. And so the whole history, you know, the post-war global drug traffic really begins with opium coming out of Burma in the 1950s. And that was a product of CIA policies, and we were sending U.S. planes. That's the origins of Air America, planes going to supply the infrastructure for the bases in Burma where the Kuomintang Chinese were building up the drug trade as a way. The ambition then was to get back into China. Well, that's not going to happen. The goal disappeared, but the drug trade has prospered and proliferated. And it's no accident that when America pulled out of Vietnam and Indochina, drug exports from that region plummeted. And then when we got involved indirectly in Afghanistan in 1980, drug production in that area soared. Not that we do it ourselves, but it's we throw American resources behind the elements who are in the drug traffic and help them to dominate against other people that we don't want to see in power. I say we, you know, I mean Washington.
Oh, indeed. Oh, it's such ugly stuff. And another reason for a program like this, Peter, I mean, imagine hearing even a whiff of this in the dominant media. Absolutely impossible.
Right.
Oh, my goodness, and this past weekend was a weekend that didn't do anything to make me patriotic. The idea of Memorial Day, a couple of years ago, I wrote a series of articles on U.S. federal holidays, couching them all in terms of hypocrisy. So I combined Memorial Day and Veterans Day together, honoring our veterans, honoring our dead, and my dominant thought is, if we didn't wage these terrible wars that there's no reason to fight, then there wouldn't be any dead to commemorate. But nobody thinks thoughts like that. So they have wall-to-wall programming honoring heroes. Oh, goodness. I call them victims, not heroes. But we need to take another break, and then we have one last segment, Peter.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to NewsHour, final segment with Peter Dale Scott. Peter, at the end of your article, you talk about some pretty obvious common sense solutions. Renouncing full-spectrum dominance, that alone may say it all. Stop antagonizing the Muslim world, less militarism, more diplomacy, those kind of things. But at the same time, Obama just appointed this horrific general to be the new Afghanistan commander, Stanley McChrystal,
right,
who James Petras will be on this program next week. He describes him as a psychopathic killer. Who made a name for himself directing special ops involved in assassinations and torture and bombing and killing civilians. And this is a guy who
wrote in the New York Times as an expert in counterinsurgency, but that's not true. He's an expert in counterterrorism. Counterinsurgency, you have to win the hearts and minds of the people. That's not the background he's coming from at all. He is, as you say, an expert in covert ops like assassinations and so on. I feel sorry for Obama, but, you know, he wanted to be president. He's bought into the global dominance mindset, and I don't, you know, for the first 100 days, I was hoping that, like Roosevelt, he would try to turn this country around, but I think he's continuing and expanding in some ways that, you know, he's more aggressive than Bush was in the Afghanistan area. And I predict, a harder fall for pushing this way. Can I just say one last thing before we close?
We haven't
talked about the fact that central in my article, that back at the beginning of this new phase of war in Afghanistan, the American Army had a list of the major drug labs, and people wanted to attack them because the drugs were financing the opposition. And it was Washington that overruled and said, you can't do this. And I have an expanded version of my article at japanfocus.org. If you go there and type in my name, you get the article. It's Rumsfeld's people, and I have to say, in a word, the PNAC people, and people like Douglas Faith, who came out of the Project for the New American Century, Paul Wolfowitz, these people were united in saying, no, don't bomb the drug labs, so that you had, as you've had since World War II, protection for the drug traffic at the highest levels in Washington. And that's one of the things that made me want to write the article. In Japan Focus, it's called America's Afghanistan, the national security and the heroin-ravaged state, because this is a horrible problem. It's not Afghans who made it happen. It was people from outside Afghanistan, and we have to blame the Pakistani ISI in large measure, but we have to also to blame the CIA, and since 2001, the Defense Department, and Robert Gates, I'm afraid, represents that continuity of policy in a way which is very harmful for this country as well as for the rest of the world.
Oh, absolutely. I do know in your article you mentioned back in 2001 we gave a pass to 25 drug labs because they belonged to the Northern Alliance and they were our guys. So what they wanted, they got, and this kind of stuff goes on.
They weren't all Northern Alliance, but they were all part of the economy which was supporting the Pakistani ISI, and that was the faction that the CIA represented. There was a mini battle going on between
the CIA. Oh, we're out of time,
Peter.
Oh, okay. We're out of time. That music means they're going to cut away momentarily. I have to stop you to my great regret, and I only have time to thank you so much. Oh, I do hope you'll come back and we can have another glorious discussion like this. I know my listeners love it, and I want to give them all that I have time for.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I'm glad that there are programs like yours.
Oh, thank you, Peter, for coming on. You make it what it is, I assure you. I'm just along for the ride. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll be on the global economic crisis tomorrow. Join us then.